and unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. As odd as it may seem, it's really important for us to come together to do these forms together. And maybe not to know why. Just to be present to these forms, sitting zazen, bowing, ringing bells. Not having an explanation. And I think it's been described to me sometimes as the hardest aspect of Zen practice for many people is they come and what are you supposed to do? You sit down. Somebody rings a bell, you're uncomfortable for 30 minutes, and then somebody rings a bell, and then you get up, and you all walk around in serried ranks, and somebody rings a bell, and then you sit down again. And then somebody rings a bell, and you get up again, and you walk around in silence. Oh yeah, it's not bells, it's clackers when you're walking around. And then you sit down again. And then somebody rings a bell and you get up. And then you chant. You do some bows with bells ringing. And then you chant. And bells are rung and so on, and then we do some bows again. But I think one of the biggest problems with spiritual practice is everybody tries to explain it away. Tries to fit it in to modern life, fit it in to our own worldview, fit it in a way that makes us comfortable doing it. That's not to say we should be uncomfortable. That's to say that ultimately we really have no fucking idea what we're doing. And any explanation for it misses the mark. So when I hear that people want to change how things are done or that people needed this or that, not necessarily here but anywhere, that it's too demanding to sit there and not know while you're sitting there. That I think still we need to do some form where we don't know why we're doing what we're doing and we have to be present to that fact. Maybe we can do other things at other times during the week where we you know, maybe like our study group that we're doing over the Zoom, or sewing, or even just getting together to do
One period is Zazen, and then sharing our experience. But largely, I think that should contribute to and build energy for actually coming together to realize we don't know what we're doing together and be in that space together. And just allow ourselves to enter that space of not knowing together, that space of discomfort with not knowing, that space where we make up stories but we don't get to talk about them, about why we're here. There has to be some place for that. Otherwise, the whole thing will fall apart. If I said nothing holds it all together, it's hard to believe. But what holds Zen together and makes it most powerful, so that we can actually recognize our relationship to ourself and the universe, is this not knowing. This experience that is not a function of utilitarianism. That isn't, oh, it makes me feel calm. That isn't, oh, it helps me concentrate so I can do six things better than before. Or that it enhances my self-image. So, enough about nothing. But that's why I think it's most important for us to participate in Saturday mornings here. Maybe to go against our own grain. Was that William Carlos Williams in The American Grain? Go against the American grain. Of I'm independent and do what I want to do. See what that feels like. So, we're about to start this class on using Norman Fisher's book, Training in Compassion, Zen Commentaries, or on Lojong, the Tibetan practice. The more I read this book, the more I realize that, I mean, I wonder if Norman knew how much he was biting off when he started this book. He's generally really great at breaking things down into digestible pieces and workable pieces. And these 59 slogans lend themselves to that. However, it's almost as though these 59 slogans house within them the entire Tibetan canon of Buddhism, and certainly subsume all of Mahayana Buddhism, and can fully be integrated into what we call Zen koans and stories. One of the issues with Zen, as we think we know it in the West, is it hasn't elaborated in great deal on the ideal of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is central to Zen. The precepts we take are the Bodhisattva precepts. They're not the monk's precepts and the nun's precepts of the Vinaya. They're based on being an awakening being. And being a being who, excuse me for saying so, gives up their own enlightenment to help others have access, become enlightened, enter the way. They are the opposite of self-centeredness. They are the opposite of utilitarianism and efficiency and effectuality. I think I made that word up. Because a bodhisattva is supported by nothing, nowhere. And yet, it's the most fulfilling experience of what we think we call the self. It's, as Suzuki Roshi was describing, the inmost request, and then laughingly said, you may find out that your inmost request is to be a bodhisattva. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are endless, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. But what is Buddha's way? Immersing ourselves in the merciful ocean of Buddha's way, like salt dissolving in to the ocean that's within us, the same drip, drip, drip at the hospital of saline solution, that's the ocean. So, the first chapter of our book is called Resolve to Begin. And these are some of the notes I have. One, training in the preliminaries. So that's the first slogan, training in the preliminaries. And I reduced Norman's little piece upon this, is to stop moaning and feeling sorry for ourselves and to recognize instead that regardless of what has happened or why, this is our life and we are the only one equipped to deal with it. No one else can do our life for us. About the same time I began, we began reading this and talking about it together, a friend of mine sent me an email that my dear old friend David Chadwick, who has the website called Cuke, CUKE.com, based on Suzuki Roshi's childhood nickname called Crooked Cucumber. Created that has anyone who's ever passed through the Zen Center and had any contact with Suzuki Roshi's reminiscences or stories or tales has every transcript or recording from Suzuki Roshi's talks and anybody's talks about Suzuki Roshi totally available, and is a network of connecting people from 1958 through the 70s who have had contact with Suzuki Roshi and their stories. So sent this email to me in which it included a question asked by Richard Baker of Suzuki Roshi on August 24th, 1967, in a lecture that Suzuki Roshi was giving, and I presume this was at Tassajara. It might have been the first practice period at which he was the Shuso. So we know that Suzuki Roshi speaks about big mind. If we've read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, there's big mind and little mind. So Richard asks, for the big mind, the bridge flows. So there's a Zen story in which there's a question. Is the bridge flowing or the creek flowing? In the big mind, beyond our little sense of relative time, the bridge flows, just as mountains walk in Dogen. In big time, we hardly exist. And yet, in that big time, beyond relative measurements of a lifetime, in an instant, we can join the bridge flowing, we can join the mountains walking. We are an extension of this big mind. So he says, for the big mind, the bridge flows. If everything has such independence, how can we find our own responsibility? Despite everything that has been said about Richard Baker, responsibility was a big deal for him. His life turned on responsibility and the ability to respond. And unlike many of the students who were participating in this practice period, he also was in the midst of the responsibility of raising the funds and creating the story that allowed Zen Mountain Center to be produced, and felt that deeply. And Suzuki Roshi said, your responsibility is under your own feet. So this is our life, and we are the only one equipped to deal with it. Our responsibility in our life and our ability to respond to this life is right under our own feet. So, then, based on that sense of personal responsibility, reflecting on our life so that we can develop the resolve and courage to begin a new life path. Now, many of us have been practicing for some time, so at some point we began a new life path, trying to figure out what this Buddha's way is, and how we might participate, how our life might be an expression of it. So then the third part of this responsibility piece, the stopping of moaning and feeling sorry, is looking honestly at our life and making a firm decision to embark on a disciplined spiritual path. Now, Norman is not saying here, as he says in the latter part of the introduction, that he's talking about being a Zen priest, or he's talking about any that Zen is the only way or something like this. He's talking about actually a firm decision to embark on a disciplined spiritual path, which might be Judaism, Islam, Christianity, yoga. But the firm decision to embark on a disciplined . That's the beginning of the training in the preliminaries. Making contact with the responsibility right under our feet. Contact with stopping pissing and moaning. Or even if we continue pissing and moaning, recognizing that that's exactly what we're doing when we're doing it. And that it's not going to solve anything. And then the second part is start a daily disciplined meditation practice. Daily. I don't care if it's 10 minutes. Some space of not doing. And then the preliminaries. Reflecting on the four points. Reading about them again and again, writing them down and thinking about them, journaling about them, drawing them, playing them, surfing them, continually bringing them up in our meditation practice and throughout the day. Just the way those Zen guys talk about being with a koan, being with mu, being with does a dog have Buddha nature. We're not talking about studying these things in a way in which one aspect of this is maybe having an intellectual structure for understanding it and being able to speak about it. But what we're truly getting at is here, this stuff seeping into us, like we become suffused in it. We're like a tea bag in water. It goes in, then it starts spreading throughout us. And we sit with that spreading and feel it. We sit with the feeling of resistance to it. And slowly we allow it and bring it throughout our entire body, even our head. So what are these four points? Tibetans say this all the time. Zen Buddhists don't say it very much. Precious life. The rarity and preciousness of this life. Of this human life. So if there are 7 billion of us on the planet, and right in one body, there might be 300 trillion other forms of life. $700 billion times 300 trillion is some huge number. The odds of winning the lottery are better than being a human being. So considering the total non-human beings versus the number of human beings, one sees immediately the rarity of being a human being. Therefore, ours is a fortunate, rare, and precious gift. And our human mind is dear beyond compare. The kicker. Considering the rarity of this gift of human life, how is it we have not, until now, at this momentous occasion, until now, we haven't thought about the best and highest way of fulfilling our human purpose? Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are endless. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. That has something to do with fulfilling our human purpose. Considering deeply the preciousness of our life, we feel inspired to do something more with our lives. My notes. Bodhisattva? Question mark. Non-self-centered life. Number two of the 4 points. It's a shocker. The absolute inevitability of death. I like how he goes about this. But check ourselves sometime during the day and ask ourselves honestly whether right now, in this very moment, we believe we're going to die. The answer is probably not. You know, in the checkout line at the grocery store or while we're watching Spider-Man. The reality of death is the most important factor of every moment of our lives. So this is why Zen guys go crazy, you know, the Zen stories, they like, you must face death, blah, blah, blah. The great death. Thanks to death, we can cross over from one moment to the next moment. Loss and death are facts of life every moment. So, one point he makes here is, each moment dies, and the next moment occurs. As far as we can tell. Moment, 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 moment. But if this moment stayed, then there'd be no space for the next moment. So throughout our life, our inhale and our exhale, letting go of our exhale is a big deal. Learning how to let go of our exhale and allowing it to just go out into the ocean, immersing, and believing that the ocean will reciprocate, that the trees will release oxygen into the air.